Session number 12138, Mr. Leslie Brower, Reel 1.
British wartime filming, Leslie Brower, Reel 1. Good. Of your early life.
Yes, I was born in 1920, which made me just the right age to be called up at 1941 at the age of 20. Student at the time in the northeast of England where I lived. I was called up and I was taken.
What were you studying?
I was studying architecture. I was called up and I was trained at Redford Barracks in Edinburgh in their signals division. I spent 6 months and after passing out I was posted to the 51st Highland Division in Inverness. As a signaller in a regiment of 25-pounder artillery. After 6 months there, I was... it wouldn't have been altogether, it would have been about 6 months. I was posted out to Africa. Can you stop it a minute? Because I've got a bit confused. I went out via Liverpool in one of the heaviest air raids that they ever had, in a convoy that went via Halifax, Nova Scotia, and then down to Freetown. We were escorted by two aircraft carrier, which we witnessed Albacore aircraft and similar aircraft landing in the high gales in the middle of the Atlantic and saw more than one aircraft come over the side of the aircraft carrier. We then went to Durban. We then found out in Durban that Burma had fallen, and although we suspected we were going out to the Far East, we were then directed up into the Middle East field of action, disembarked at Port Tufik and taken by train to Cairo into the Royal Artillery camp, and I was seconded to the Royal Horse Artillery, 2nd Regiment Artillery, which had come from Greece and fought a very brilliant action in the famous Knightsbridge Box before retreating back to Cairo. We were then formed once again into a battery and a regiment and went into the desert and had various skirmishes with the Italians and the Germans for a period of time before the Battle of Alamein. Stop for a minute.
When did you first get a camera?
Well, I've always been interested in photography, and I was in the university camera club, and I did very good work.
Was that at Newcastle?
King's College, Newcastle. And then I started taking interest in movie cameras, but at those days, of course, they were very, very box camera-ish, very amateurish. And I bought a Kodak 88 movie camera with a fixed lens and took it with me when I went to war.
So you bought that in England?
I bought that in England, never even thinking that I'd ever be able to use it.
Had you taken films with it in England already?
I had, but I'd been arrested.
Can you say something about that?
Yes, I came back on my embarkation leave from Inverness, where I was with the 51st Highland Div, and I bought the camera in Newcastle, and I went up into the hills to take pictures on the River Tyne, nothing to do with the army, nothing to do with military or industry, but just beautiful scenery, and a farmer saw me photographing, even though I was in uniform. And when I was walking back, there was some military policemen waiting for me, and I was arrested. And I said, but I wasn't taking any photographs, so they confiscated the camera. They developed the half the film, and they realized it wasn't anything military. They rang up my unit in Edinburgh, Inverness, and got in touch with my commanding officer, and the whole thing died a natural death. But that was the only time I was ever suspected of being a spy. I went out with a camera.
If you were taking film of the countryside, was this colour film that you
no,
had?
No, a colour film wasn't... I hadn't started colour film at the time. I was only working in black and white.
Were you surprised by being arrested?
Well,
or were you aware that having a camera was an unusual thing at that time?
An incident came to my mind. In 1935, when I was a tiny little boy in infant school, I was brought... Well, I wasn't a youngster.
In 1925?
1920, no. It would have been early... before the 30s. In Tynemouth, you'll be able to check on these dates, in Tynemouth, the Graf Zeppelin... came over, one of the Zeppelins came over the River Tyne at very low level, and we were all taken into the courtyard to see it. And it dawned on me at that age that they must have been making a perfect photographic record of the whole industries right along the River Tyne, right up to Pontiel and to ICI. And that came to my mind at the time when they were stopping me, because they don't need photographs, they've got them. I forgot. I think it was the first big Zeppelin, commercial Zeppelin that the Germans made.
Can you remember how much the camera cost?
Yes, I think it was about £11, which is a lot of money. I had to save up for that.
And a reel of 50-foot film?
Oh, I shouldn't have think that was more than about £1. Most. I doubt if it was that, because...
Which included the developing, did it?
Oh, that included the developing, yes, 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 yes.
Was there an amateur cine club in the university?
No, there wasn't. It was purely... I only bought the cine camera shortly after I'd joined the army, because in my mind I thought, well, I'm going to risk it. I'm going to take a record. I'm going to do something in my life. I may come out, I may not, but I want a record of it for my children and my grandchildren in 50 years' time. And this is fact, it worked out that way. So it was just simply a thought for the future.
Had you previously asked your unit officer or...
No, I never. I would either get caught and have it confiscated, or they'd turn a blind eye. And they were very progressive. They turned a blind eye. They knew I was doing it. I was most surprised that they never said, well, when the war's over, or whenever you get filmed, can we have a record for the regiment? They never even asked me that.
So how much film did you take with you on leaving
Well,
England?
I took about a half a dozen reels when I went, but I knew, I'd already inquired that I could buy more film in Cairo, or I could buy in Bombay if I was going to the Far East, and in Durban, where we all knew where we, although it was highly secret, we roughly knew if we were going to one theatre of war or another, we would stop at Durban or Cape Town. On the way, which we did, and although I didn't buy anything in Durban, we were then told that we weren't going to Bombay, we were going to Port Tewfik, so we knew we were going to the Middle East Theatre of War. So I waited until I got to Cairo, but I had enough film that lasted me quite a long time. I didn't start using it until I actually was in Egypt.
Were you not tempted to film Durban?
Pardon?
Were you not tempted to film
in
Durban?
No, I wasn't. I thought, well, if I was going to have if I had difficulty in getting any film, I'd rather use it in a war situation, which was to conserve.
I interrupted you just after you had arrived at before El Alamein. Could you describe your time both as a soldier and as an amateur cameraman from Alamein onwards?
Well, I think the incident really starts before Alamein. We were trained and re-equipped and did manoeuvres near Cairo, and then we went out. Of course, we didn't know what Alamein was Alamein and what was going to happen. We went along the coastal strip road, with the tarmac road, for a certain length of time, and then we came off the road and turned south, and we were taken quite a long way into the real desert, into the Qatara Depression and south of the Qatara Depression, and we were in battle formation with the tanks on the outside, the guns inside, and the soft equipment in the center, and because of the arrangement of the Battle of Alamein, which we didn't know individually, it was suspected that the Germans were going to make an offensive in the south because they'd been fed with false information. Fortunately for us, they didn't attack our particular section, but they did attack other sections where the Australians were. And then there came a time when we were told to move north. And as you'd see in the film, our unit moved forward across the Katara Depression, and you saw how our guns were stuck and the quads were stuck. And it took an awful long time and a tremendous amount of effort to get back onto the hard desert from the south. Then we were moved into position for the actual Battle of Alamein, where there was miles and miles of guns, about 300 guns, batteries, I gather, from the sea right down to the south, and they opened up on a 36-hour continuous bombardment, which some of us suffered by loss of hearing, and I was one of them.
Could you describe exactly what you were doing during this?
Well, I was, after having some tests at our job, I was one of the best, and I was put in the command signals.
This was before El Alamein. You went back to headquarters.
Yes, we went back to headquarters, and
you came out top.
I came out top
as a signaller.
As a signaller, yes. And I was sent to the back to the guns in the regimental position as receiving signals from headquarters and from the OPs.
From both,
yes, because we were directing the where to fire for the barrage. And then after a few hours of a continuous heavy gunfire, within the immediate sound of four guns and the background of hundreds of other guns, I began to lose my hearing. Sadly, I was getting the wrong messages and interpreting the wrong way. And, of course, this was, from the point of view of the guns, this was a terrible thing to happen. But from my own point of view, I was helpless. And I was more or less dragged off the telephone. Somebody took my place, and I complained that I had terrible earache. And I was...
In both ears?
In my left ear, and more than my right. And they took me to the, let me go to see the doctor, and he just said here's a couple of aspirins, because frankly he had more things to think about.
This was during the course of the battle.
Yes, yes. I mean, looking back, I mean, I was a nobody, but I went back and I was no longer a signaller. That was the end of my army career for promotion in that field. So... The next scenes that you would see as the battle... Sorry.
Well, at the start, the film starts with a line of tanks advancing near a battle, I think you said.
Yes. Well, that would have been the formation of... The tanks would be supporting, would be the attacking unit. The guns would be the supporting unit. And if the tanks got into a very difficult position, if they came up against heavy guns, anti-tank guns, and tanks of a stronger formation, they would request the 25-pounder guns to open fire, giving them... one of our officers would be with a leading tank as an observation post operative, and he would direct the gunfire onto the target in front of the line of tanks. And you see the line of tanks advancing in line. Sometimes they advanced in echelons at an angle, sometimes in a straight line, and we followed closely behind in the guns.
And one also sees the letter H.
That stood for our battery. That was H battery of the 2nd Royal Horse Artillery. We had other regiments of Royal Horse Artillery which spread along the line. But ordinary soldiers didn't seem to have much contact with anybody else. We were in our own little environment, and that was the limit of our visual contacts.
Within that little environment, your film shows various intimate scenes, like yourself shaving, waking up.
Yes. Well, there was incidents where a battle could be interrupted by a Khamseen wind, which was a solid wall of sand being blown across the desert, which could last 2 or 3 days, and you were helpless. You couldn't do anything. And it was very sad. If a tank battle was taking place and this happened, the tanks could even get mixed up, the German, the Italian and the British tanks, and when it was all over, they're all mixed together as if somebody had stirred them up. This actually happened. When it was over, of course, there was a tremendous amount of work to be done to clear the sand, this fine sand, out of equipment and out of guns. So it did a tremendous amount of damage.
When your deafness was reported and confirmed, were you invalided out of the unit, or...?
No, it happened that I got even worse, because I was still in the unit, but when we got up to Bizerta before the invasion of Anzio, of Sicily, there was an epidemic of infective hepatitis. Nobody knows how it happens. There's about four or five soldiers in my unit caught it. It was a horrible thing. We all nearly died.
You caught it?
Yes, yes. And I was sent, at the time America was already in the war, and we were sent to the American First Army Hospital in Bizerta at the time. And I've just got to thank the American doctors for saving my life.
No, my question also was an attempt to find out whether you carried on filming with battery even after your deafness prevented you operating as a signaller.
I wasn't deaf all the time, but at certain end of the voices I couldn't make out very clearly. It didn't affect me to the extent that I couldn't hear people speaking. But when you're listening in on a radio, and these radios were very primitive, and telephone, field telephones of crackling and distortion, I had a hell of a job sorting it out. I mean, getting a list of figures and numbers and instructions, you had to have very, very clear hearing, and I began to lose certain ends of the vibrations, and I missed so much, and it was pointless me carrying on doing it.
What were you transferred?
Well, I was actually working on the guns after that, you know, despite the fact
potentially even worse,
which made it worse. But I got paid for it recently.
So some of these intimate scenes might have been both before and after.
Yes, Alamein. I mean, these were the my feeling was that in the whole sphere of a world war, ordinary people went on with their ordinary lives, and ordinary soldiers who'd been postmen and working in shops or offices suddenly swept into a new environment had to accept it, and they just went on living their normal, becoming their normal selves, even under terrible conditions. And if they made tea and had a brew up, that was something nice if you could stop and do it. Otherwise, you're on the move and just drank horrible tasting water, or ate bully beef, cold bully beef. But if you had five minutes in which you could cook something, you try and make yourself some stew or all kinds of things that was offered to you. There was a M&V tinned soup, which was vegetable soup, meat and vegetable soup, which tasted delicious when you'd been living on bully beef for about a month. And even tea made in the bracken water, and the horrible water tasting of the antiseptic, tasted delicious when you hadn't had a hot drink, a nice hot drink with plenty of sugar in it, after hours and hours of travelling and your mouth thick with sand.
One of your sequences shows Sergeant Major Smith with binoculars apparently sheltering behind a truck during an attack.
Yes.
Would you have been confident that he wouldn't have yelled out to you, put your camera away and get on with your...
There was a remarkable camaraderie between all of us in the regiment. First, it wasn't... I mean, we called him Sergeant Major and all that, but everybody respected everybody. We all did our jobs as best as we could, and if we were confident and competent in our jobs, that was it. And we... you couldn't observe military complete military discipline under these circumstances. You had to rely on the confidence you had in your colleagues.
And was the fact that you had a camera known throughout the second?
Well, it must have been, because they were seen. I mean, if the sergeant major saw me photographing these things, and he even held this shell in his hand, which you see, and that shell came down within 10 foot of us, a high explosive shell. If it had gone off, we wouldn't be here now to talk about it. And he held it there. I mean, it was a brave thing to hold it, because it could still have been live, and if he'd given it a hard jab, it could have gone off. But he didn't object to us to be photographing him holding.
Did you ever see anyone else with a small camera like your own?
I did. There was one chap I met, actually, when we were in Lega with another regiment. It wasn't... I don't know what he was doing, but he had an identical camera to me, and... it was a hello goodbye situation. Otherwise, I'd have asked him his home address and given him mine. But I never saw him again. But there were other people doing it.
How did you get the material processed?
I went, when we went back to Cairo at odd times. I went back with it. We had to go back to our base in Almaza, I think it was called. I used to go to the Kodak. Shop in the middle of Cairo where they developed it, and they had a screen which they projected or film. And of course there I met other soldiers, and mostly Australians and South Africans who had cameras, most of them flyers. One of them, one scene we watched, we were watching each other's films, was this flyer with his colleagues who sunk a submarine in the Med, and the whole action was there on 8mm film.
And presumably other people had 16mm.
I never saw any 16mm other than professionals.
But Kodak did handle both 16
and
8.
Oh, yes,
and,
yes, yes. But I mean, 16mm would have been rather heavy and bulky to carry around. The cameras, I saw 16mm cameras, and of course they were a damn sight more expensive as well. But I think that 16mm, I felt... if I had have been able to afford 16mm, I don't know whether I'd have taken it. I think I would have stuck to 8mm, because it was easier to conceal and easier to carry around in a pack.
Could you say something about how the camera worked?
It was a remarkable little camera. You wound up the
it was a Brownie.
It was the Kodak 8mm equivalent to a Brownie camera, with a little fixed lens, which could only take one particular focal length, and it was really very reliable. I was amazed what it could do. Even shots of airplanes thousands of feet up in the sky, it actually recorded it, and it never went wrong. Nothing ever happened to it. It always wound up when I needed it.
And was it proof against the sand?
Well, that I made myself. I mean, I carried it in a leather cloth container I'd made so that it would be protected. And as the film stock itself was in a little can sealed with a sort of elastoplast type of material, it was perfectly safe from dust. But this dust, especially in the Qatara Depression, wasn't sand. It was like flour. And it literally got everywhere. You would have seen when these guns were being towed and the wheels were ground down into this dust, almost, we could imagine, moon dust. It was a flowery constituency with a peculiar smell. We all noticed the smell in the Qatara Depression. And it was below sea level. And it was hell to get the guns moving, the weight of the guns there. We were using sand tracks, metal sand tracks, all continuously to get them to go forward. And it meant unhooking the limber and the gun, getting the quad out of the sand, and then pulling the guns ourselves, manoeuvring back onto the hookup onto the...
Your film records such a scene.
Yes, it actually shows it.
What form of censorship was your film subject to?
Well, that was something which I never saw, but there was obviously intelligence had an officer in the Kodak place seeing everything. I know I had some pretty harrowing scenes. I know that I shot one scene of a Stuka attack on an anti-tank gun. And a direct hit and bodies and everything shooting on every direction. I never saw that. That wasn't shown. It never was there when I went to see it.
So after Kodak processed the material,
they censored and cut out what they.
And then Kodak showed you the
what was left. Yeah. But they were pretty easy. I mean, they let the general warfare shots go through, which surprised me because it was a very advanced way of looking at things, but I think there was a reason. I think that the Australians and the South Africans would have created hell if any of their films had been confiscated, and I think it might have been bad if British had the same didn't have the same treatment. Which brings to me to the point that there must have been lots of other English soldiers who had cameras. Because Kodak must have been showing them all the time. So if you can find out a bit about this Kodak office and showroom in Cairo at the time, maybe you can trace something of where these people are. I can't believe I was the only one.
And where did you store the film after it had been processed?
In my kit bag.
And you had it with you until you returned to the UK?
No. I sent them back. I never had any reason. I just wrapped them up and sent them. They were never censored. Well, I assume it was realised that they were already censored in Cairo, you know, when they were developed. But I was never approached and asked that. Which, when I look back now, is quite amazing. It got home. The cans got home.
And do you know whether your family viewed them at home?
Oh, I wouldn't. I doubt it. I mean, amateur camera cine stuff was very, very rare in those days, in the 40s and 50s, early 50s. They just kept them for me when I got back.
And when did you decide to edit them?
About 1950. I left the army in 1945, 46 almost, and I just didn't bother about anything. I knew they were there. It wasn't till the 50s that I began to take an interest again in filming, and I've got an awful lot of films from 1950 up to now.
And when you edited the material, did you try to keep to the strict chronology of events?
No, I didn't. I think I was just putting it all together and just in little, because I didn't have an editing office. I had to just hang the film up on a shelf and long strips and tie a bit of paper on that this was this and this was that and this was the other and put them all together as I felt would be of interest. I didn't show too many people. It was there. Wasn't till the event of video that my son said, why don't we copy it onto video? And after that, anybody can look at it. I've shown it lots of people. And strange enough, they've all been fascinated by it. Because now it is history of 50 years old.
To return to our own war experience, after you came out of hospital in Bizerta, you did a long train journey.
Yes, we were sent back to a convalescent place. It went back to Cairo.
So your convalescence there was more from hepatitis than it was from
Oh, yes. The hearing never came up anymore. I mean, it just didn't come up. But the hepatitis was pretty rough, I'll tell you. I was ill for a hell of a long time after that.
With recurrent spasms.
Yes. It was a terrible thing. But they didn't seem to recognise that in the British Army medical. I don't think they knew enough about it. Even the Americans didn't know enough about it. Strangely enough, you now hear an awful lot about hepatitis B and all these things, you know. But in those days, there was a lot of research going into it. They knew it came from infestation from rats. So obviously it had come into the food chain that we were no longer eating out of our own tins. We were in a battery situation, regimental situation, where they put up a marquee and we'd all eat from the field kitchens. And it's possible that local food was used, vegetables, and infected with rats. And I was one of the unlucky ones. As I say, about half a dozen of us caught this. There was the whole of the tent I was in the hospital. There was black South Africans, there was Australians, all Americans, everybody, all of us ailed.